This is going to be a fun and fascinating episode because we're going to ask an AI bot how to translate the Bible and some specific Bible questions. ChatGPT, in case you hadn't heard, is what some people are calling the biggest advance in technology since the iPhone. So we want to put it to the test. What does it know about the Bible? What does it know about translation? How much can it replace a specialist if you have a very specific question about a textual variant, about an interpretation, etc.? I'm Andrew Case, this is Working for the Word, and let's take this AI for a spin. So for those of you who haven't heard about it yet, ChatGPT is an artificial intelligence chatbot developed by OpenAI, and it launched back in November of 2022. It grew to 100 million users faster than any other technology in history so far, and it's garnered attention for its detailed responses and articulate answers across many domains of knowledge. Now, this thing is very versatile. For example, it can write and debug computer programs. It can compose music and student essays and answer test questions and write poetry and song lyrics and all kinds of things. So we're going to put it to the test. My first question for it is, what's the best way to translate the Bible? By the way, if you want to try this yourself, this is a free service. So if you go to chat.openai.com, you can get your own account and start asking all the burning questions that you have. So what's the best way to translate the Bible? It says, the best way to translate the Bible is a subjective matter and depends on one's personal preferences and beliefs. Some people believe that the most accurate translation is a literal one that closely adheres to the original text, while others prefer a more dynamic translation that prioritizes readability and cultural context. Ultimately, the best way to translate the Bible is one that effectively communicates the intended meaning to its intended audience. There are many different English translations of the Bible, each with its own strengths and weaknesses. Some of the most widely used include the King James Version, the NIV, the NRSV, the ESV. When choosing a translation, it's important to consider the purpose for which you want to use it, such as personal study, public worship, or teaching. Additionally, you may want to consider the intended audience and the cultural context in which the translation will be used. In any case, it is important to keep in mind that no translation is perfect, and all translations involve some degree of interpretation. Therefore, it's important to approach the Bible with an open mind, a humble spirit, and a willingness to consider multiple perspectives. End quote. So pretty impressive so far. It's so interesting how articulate it is and how much extra information it gives me after such a simple question. You know, what's the best way to translate the Bible is all I asked. And it gave a lot of extra interesting things. Now let's see about this next question I asked it. If I'm translating the Bible for a language that has never had the Bible, what principles should I follow? It says, if you're translating the Bible into a language that has never had the Bible, you have a unique opportunity to help people gain access to the foundational text of Christianity. When translating the Bible for the first time, it's important to follow certain principles in order to ensure that the translation is accurate, clear, and culturally appropriate. Here are some key principles to consider. Number one, use a formal equivalence approach. This means that the translation should be as literal as possible so that the meaning of the original text is preserved as accurately as possible. Number two, consider cultural context. When translating the Bible into a new language, it's important to consider the cultural context in which the translation will be used. This may involve adjusting the vocabulary and grammar used in the translation to make it more accessible to the intended audience. Number three, involve local experts. To ensure that the translation is culturally appropriate and that the intended meaning is conveyed effectively, it's important to involve local experts who understand the language and culture of the intended audience. This may include linguists, theologians, and local leaders. Number four, use clear and simple language. The Bible should be translated into clear, simple language that is easy to understand. This will help to ensure that the intended meaning is communicated effectively to people who may have limited education or familiarity with religious texts. Number 5, use a process of consultation and review. To ensure the accuracy and quality of the translation, it's important to involve a team of people who will review and provide feedback on the translation. This may include a review of the text by a committee of experts and a process of testing the translation in real-life situations to ensure that it is clear and understandable to the intended audience. Remember, translating the Bible is a complex and challenging task, and it's important to approach it with care, attention to detail, and a commitment to accuracy and cultural relevance, end quote. So I don't know about you, but super impressed so far with the ability to synthesize this and this being done by a machine. Now let's go to the next question. I asked it, what are the best tools and resources for translating the Bible? When translating the Bible, it's important to have access to high-quality tools and resources that will help ensure the accuracy and quality of the translation. Here are some of the best tools and resources for translating the Bible. Number 1, original language texts. The best place to start when translating the Bible is with the original language texts, such as the Hebrew and Greek texts of the Old and New Testaments, respectively. These texts provide the foundation for all Bible translations and are the starting point for determining the intended meaning of the original text. Number 2, lexicons and dictionaries. Lexicons and dictionaries are essential tools for translating the Bible, as they provide definitions and context for the words and phrases used in the original language texts. Number 3, commentaries and study Bibles. Commentaries and study Bibles can provide valuable insights and perspectives on the meaning of individual passages, which can be helpful when translating the Bible. Number 4, translation software. There are several translation software programs available that can help streamline the translation process and ensure consistency in the use of terminology and grammar. Number 5, consultation with experts. When translating the Bible, it's important to consult with experts in the field of biblical studies, linguistics, and theology who can provide guidance and feedback on the translation. Number 6, previous translations. Reviewing previous translations of the Bible into other languages can also be helpful in determining the best way to translate certain passages and in understanding the cultural context in which the translation will be used. Number 7, community feedback. Finally, it's important to gather feedback from the intended audience and members of the community to ensure that the translation is accurate, clear, and culturally appropriate. Overall, when translating the Bible, it's important to have access to a range of high-quality tools and resources and to approach the task with care, attention to detail, and a commitment to accuracy and cultural relevance. End quote. Now, as a follow-up, I said, you mentioned translation software. What software options are there for Bible translation, and what are their strengths and weaknesses? So it answered, there are several software options available for Bible translation, each with its own strengths and weaknesses. Here are some of the most commonly used software programs and their key features. Number 1, Paratext, and it gives a summary of what it is. Number 2, Fieldworks Language Explorer, or FLEX. And for those of you who don't work in linguistics and use the software, FLEX is a software program, it says, this is the chat. FLEX is a software program that provides tools for language analysis and lexicon development, as well as tools for translation and consultation. It's designed to be user-friendly and is particularly well-suited for use in the field, making it a useful tool for Bible translation in remote or under-resourced regions. And then number 3, it gives BibleWorks and explains what it is. And number 4, it gives Olive Tree Bible Software. An odd choice, not sure why that came up. Maybe because it's free, I think, but it does not mention Logos. And then it ends with a little summary saying, ultimately, the best software for Bible translation will depend on a variety of factors, including the size and complexity of the translation project, the level of exegetical and linguistic expertise required, and the resources available. In any case, it is important to choose a software program that meets the specific needs of the translation team and provides the tools and resources necessary to ensure a high-quality translation. End quote. Now, my next question was, what are the best websites and books to learn about Bible translation? Here's what it said. There are many resources available for learning more about Bible translation, including websites and books. Here are some of the best websites and books to consider. Websites, and then it gives me a list. Wycliffe Bible Translators, and then it gives me a summary of who they are. SIL International gives me a summary. United Bible Societies, and again, a summary. Then it has books as a heading and a list. Number one, Bible Translation, History, Process, and Policies by Mark L. Strauss. And this book provides a comprehensive overview of the history and process of Bible translation and covers a range of important topics, including the challenges of translation, the role of the Holy Spirit in translation, and the role of Bible translation in mission and evangelism. Number two, A Handbook of Bible Translation by Keith Lim. This book provides a practical guide to the process of Bible translation and covers key topics such as translation principles, translation strategy, and translation quality assessment. Number three, Bible Translation, Frames of Reference by Laman Sana. This book explores the cultural and historical context of Bible translation and examines the challenges and opportunities involved in translating the Bible into different cultural and linguistic contexts. Number four, An Introduction to Translation Studies by Jeremy Munday. This book provides a comprehensive overview of translation studies and covers key topics such as translation theory, translation practice, and the translation of religious texts, including the Bible. These resources can be a great starting point for learning more about Bible translation and gaining a deeper understanding of the challenges and opportunities involved in this important work. End quote. So then I asked, where can I go to study and get a degree in Bible translation? And it said, there are several universities and colleges that offer degree programs in Bible translation or related fields such as linguistics, biblical studies, and mission studies. Here are some of the universities and colleges that you might consider. SIL International, and then it gives a little summary. Wycliffe Bible Translators Institute, and it gives a little summary. Moody Bible Institute. The Moody Bible Institute offers a Bachelor of Arts in Bible Translation and Linguistics, which provides students with a solid foundation in biblical studies, linguistics, and translation theory. Number four, St. Paul's United Theological College. And it gives a little summary there, and it also summarizes Dallas International University, which is on the list. And then in summary, it says, these are just a few examples of universities and colleges that offer degree programs in Bible translation or related fields. When considering a university or college for your studies, it's important to consider factors such as the quality of the program, the experience and expertise of the faculty, and the availability of resources and support for your studies. Now then I asked it, how many languages still need a translation of the Bible? And it said, as of my knowledge cutoff in 2021, because I think that's when the data model was trained, until 2021, and it doesn't know basically anything past 2021, it says there were still over 1,500 languages in the world that did not have a complete translation of the Bible or any portion of the Bible. This number is constantly changing as new translations are completed and new languages are identified, but it is estimated that there are still many languages that need a translation of the Bible. It's important to note that not all of these languages have a significant number of speakers, and many are considered endangered or at risk of becoming extinct. Nevertheless, the need for Bible translation continues to be a significant challenge and opportunity, as many people around the world still do not have access to the Bible in their own language. Bible translation organizations such as Wycliffe Bible Translators and SIL International are working to address this need by partnering with local communities and providing resources and support for Bible translation projects. These efforts are helping to make the Bible more widely available to people around the world and are contributing to the preservation of endangered languages and cultures. End quote. Now then I asked it, what countries have the most languages still in need of a Bible translation? And it said, it is difficult to determine which countries have the most languages still in need of a Bible translation, as the number and distribution of languages is constantly changing, and some countries have large numbers of languages spoken within their borders. However, it is generally recognized that countries in Africa, Asia, and South America have the largest number of languages still in need of a Bible translation. And then it gives some more summaries as to each of these regions. So Africa, Asia, South America, kind of breaks those down. I'm not going to read all of it, but really interesting stuff. So then I was curious, and I said, have you heard of the podcast Working for the Word? And it said, yes, I have heard of the podcast Working for the Word. Working for the Word is a podcast that focuses on language, translation, and mission, and how these topics intersect with the study of biblical languages, such as biblical Hebrew and Greek. The podcast features interviews with scholars, translators, and other experts, as well as discussions and insights into the challenges and rewards of language learning and translation work. If you're interested in learning more about biblical languages and translation, Working for the Word may be a valuable resource for you to check out. End quote. So this is really interesting because none of that wording was produced by me anywhere on the internet. So it couldn't have just gone to the podcast webpage or to Apple Podcasts and looked at the summary and gotten this information, because my summary is quite different than this. And so I don't think it listened to all the podcasts. I think it would have had to have read the descriptions of each podcast in its training model, and then it synthesized all of the descriptions of each podcast and perhaps read some of the reviews and then synthesized it all together into this paragraph. So really impressed. I think it did a good job. So then, in honor of my friend Mark Ward and in honor of our recent guest, Josh Barzon, I asked it, is the KJV the only good translation of the Bible in English? So let's see if this AI is a KJV onlyist. It says, the King James Version of the Bible is a widely recognized and respected translation, but it is not the only good translation of the Bible in English. There are many other translations that are widely used and respected, including the NIV, the NRSV, and the ESV, and the NASB, among others. Each translation has its own strengths and weaknesses, and the best translation for an individual will depend on their personal needs and preferences. It's also important to note that the KJV was translated in the early 17th century, and the English language has changed significantly since then. As a result, some people may find that the language and phrasing of the KJV is difficult to understand or outdated. In these cases, a more modern translation may be a better choice. Ultimately, the best translation of the Bible will depend on the individual's needs, preferences, and goals, and it is often recommended to use multiple translations to get a more comprehensive understanding of the text. End quote. So I think my friends Mark and Josh would probably give it a thumbs up for that answer. Well done, little chat GPT. Now, the next question I had for it was, how many languages of the world have a complete translation of the Bible? And it gave me the answer of around 2,000 languages, with a bunch of extra things that it said, including describing efforts that are being done, that are underway by different organizations to translate the Bible into more languages, etc. Then I changed topics and I asked it, is the Passion Translation of the Bible a trustworthy translation? So this is an interesting question that I talked about a long time ago on this podcast. If you haven't listened to that episode, I would highly encourage you to check it out. This is what it said. The Passion Translation of the Bible is a recent translation that has gained some popularity. However, it is not widely considered to be one of the most reliable or scholarly translations of the Bible. One of the main criticisms of the TPT is that it is a highly interpretive translation, and the translator has used significant liberty in rewording and reinterpreting passages in the text. This has led some to question the accuracy and trustworthiness of the translation. Additionally, the TPT has been criticized for some of its interpretive choices, which are seen by some as not being in line with historical or scholarly understandings of the text. It is important to note that all translations of the Bible are interpretations to some degree, and each translator must make decisions about how to translate and interpret the text. However, when choosing a Bible translation, it's important to consider the reputation of the translator and publisher, and to look for a translation that is widely considered to be accurate, reliable, and scholarly. And then it has a kind of synthesizing paragraph that I won't read. But so far, I am very impressed. Now, could this thing have any weaknesses? Or is it just going to replace me on this podcast and replace all the consultants out there and maybe even replace all the mother tongue translators out there so we won't have to worry about Bible translation anymore? Well, let me share with you a conversation I had with it along the lines of something that requires more specialist knowledge, where I had some more expertise than it had and the cracks began to show. So if you want to see the limits of this thing, go ahead and ask it some questions about a field where you're an expert And I think you'll begin to see some things and it just gets plain wrong. So let me give you a little background to this series of questions that I asked it about Zechariah 5:6. As I've mentioned in past episodes, I've been working slowly but surely on a series in Spanish that's a full video course on textual criticism of the Old Testament. So I've been working on this next lesson, which is video number 12, which is on the methods of textual criticism. So I'm using a specific example that we're going to walk through the whole methodology or process of textual criticism of Zechariah 5:6, and specifically the reading in the Masoretic text that says, this is their Einam. And in the Septuagint, it says, this is their iniquity. So I've been immersed in this textual problem for days. So I know the ins and outs of this problem because I'm explaining it in very meticulous detail for this video. And so I asked it first, what is the textual variant in Zechariah 5:6? And the chat responded, the textual variant involves a difference between the Masoretic text and the Septuagint manuscripts. In the MT, the verse reads, and I said, what is it? And he said, this is the ephah that goes forth. And he said, this is their iniquity in all the land. In the LXX, the verse reads, and I said, what is it? And he said, this is a measure going forth. And he said, this is their eye in all the earth. The difference between ephah and measure in the first part of the verse is relatively minor, as they both refer to a type of unit of measure. However, the difference between iniquity and I in the second part of the verse is significant and changes the meaning of the passage. The MT's iniquity suggests that the ephah represents the sins of the people which are pervasive throughout the land. The Septuagint's quote-unquote eye, on the other hand, suggests that the ephah represents a symbol of God's watchfulness over the entire earth. It is worth noting that while the MT is the primary text used by Jewish scholars and translators, the LXX is often cited by Christian scholars and translators. Therefore, depending on the translation or interpretation, the textual variant may be of greater or lesser importance. Okay, so there's an obvious factual error in its answer. So I called it out. I said, the MT actually has their eye, and the LXX has their iniquity. So it got them reversed. It answered, I apologize for the mistake in my previous answer. You are correct that the Masoretic text has their eye in Zechariah 5:6, and the Septuagint has their iniquity. Therefore, the textual variant in Zechariah 5:6 is the difference between eye and iniquity in the second part of the verse, while the first part of the verse is the same in both the MT and the LXX, referring to ephah as a measure going forth. And then it has another little summary. Okay, so it's teachable. Now, I kept the conversation going, and I said, what's the best reading in the case of the variant, their eye? It said, in the case of the textual variant, where the Masoretic text has their eye and the Septuagint has their iniquity, both readings have support among scholars and translators. The MT's, their eye, is supported by the Dead Sea Scrolls, the Targum, the Syriac Peshitta, and the Vulgate, among other ancient versions. This reading suggests that the ephah, which is a container used to measure grain, represents God's watchful eye over the land of Judah, and that the iniquity of the people will not escape his notice. On the other hand, the Septuagint's, their iniquity, is supported by some Greek manuscripts and versions, as well as some early Christian writers. This reading suggests that the ephah represents the sins of the people which are pervasive throughout the land, and that judgment will come upon them as a result. Ultimately, the choice of which reading to use depends on factors such as the context, the purpose of the translation, and the theological implications of each variant. Some translators may prefer one reading over the other based on their understanding of the text and their audience, while others may choose to include a footnote or a note to acknowledge the textual variant, end quote. Now, unfortunately, it had a couple more factual errors at least. So, first of all, I know that there is no Dead Sea Scroll fragment of Zechariah 5:6. So, we have the Scroll of the Minor Prophets from Cave 4, but 5:6 is not represented there at all. And so, it said that the Dead Sea Scrolls supports the reading of the MT. That's totally false, because it doesn't even exist. And then number two, it said that the MT is supported by the Syriac. The Syriac actually supports the Septuagint. Now, another interesting point of information that it didn't mention that would be really helpful is that Symmachus, the reviser of the Septuagint, the early Jewish reviser, he actually corrected the Septuagint to put something that reflected the Masoretic text more closely with their eye. So before I called it out on some of these errors, I wanted to play with it a little bit and see what it said. So I asked it, "You said that the MT reading of their eye is supported by the Dead Sea Scrolls. Where is that exactly? What scroll and where can I see it?" And it answered with a lot of confidence, "The fragment of Zechariah 5:6 in the Dead Sea Scrolls is found in 4Q80F or 4QX2G, has two different names, a manuscript fragment from Cave 4 at Qumran. The fragment contains only part of Zechariah 5:6 and reads their eye in agreement with the Masoretic text." And then it goes on to tell me where the fragment is housed and all this stuff. And it says, "Fortunately, high-resolution images of the Dead Sea Scrolls are available online," and it gave me a link, but that link did not actually lead me to any images of the scroll. And so I said, "I've looked at 4QX2G, and Zechariah 5:6 isn't in that manuscript." And it said, "I apologize for the confusion. You are correct that Zechariah 5:6 is not included in that manuscript. I was mistaken, and I apologize for the error." Wouldn't it be nice if more conversations on the internet went like this in the comments and on Twitter and who knows where else? So it went on to say some more interesting things. I won't read them. And then it finished with, "The MT is a highly respected and authoritative text, and scholars generally consider it to be the best representation of the original Hebrew text. Again, I apologize for the error in my previous response. Thank you for bringing it to my attention." End quote. So then I asked, what are the arguments for their eye being the correct original reading? And it said there are several arguments in favor of their eye being the correct original reading in Zechariah 5:6. Number one, the MT's reading is supported by other ancient versions and manuscripts. This suggests that the MT preserves an older tradition than the LXX. Number two, the context supports the MT's reading. The immediate context of Zechariah 5:6 speaks of a vision of a flying scroll that goes throughout the land bringing judgment to those who have sinned. The ephah in Zechariah 5:6 is part of the same vision, and the idea of God's watchful eye fits well with the theme of divine judgment. Now, I won't read its next argument, but obviously you can see there's a big hole in this argument. I'm not sure where it got this argument, if it's trying to reason on its own, or if maybe it read some amateur student essay on this somewhere, I have no idea. But the variant is their eye, not his eye, where it could be referring to God or something like that. And it also went on to talk more about this idea in point four. It said the idea of divine watchfulness is consistent with other passages in the Old Testament. The idea of God's watchful eye over his people is a common theme in the Old Testament. For example, Deuteronomy 11:12, etc., etc. Overall, these arguments suggest that their eye is the more likely original reading in Zechariah. However, as with any textual variant, the exact reasons for the differences between the MT and LXX are difficult to determine with certainty. So I called it out on its argument, and I said the idea of divine watchfulness as an argument in favor of their eye doesn't make sense because it would have to be his eye if it were referring to God. And so it said, "You are correct, and I apologize for the mistake. I misspoke earlier when I said that their eye refers to God's watchfulness. Rather, the idea behind their eye is that the woman in the ephah is being watched or monitored. The ephah in Zechariah 5:6 is described as having a lead cover with a woman inside, which symbolizes wickedness or sin. And it says, again, I apologize for any confusion caused by my earlier response. Thank you for bringing this to my attention." So what I was hoping that it would eventually bring up are some of these following things that I've written in the video. So number one, the Septuagint translator may have had a text with Avol Nam, their iniquity, but the Masoretes had access to different manuscripts with Reinam, their eye. If this is true, the origin of Avol Nam, their iniquity, could have been original or could have come from an early scribal error wherein the scribe confused the Yod and the Vav which is a common mistake that we see in places like Isaiah 5:29 in the Qumran scrolls. Number two, the Septuagint translator may have had a text with Einam, their eye, but he made a deliberate logical alteration that in his mind was a correction based on the context. Number three, an early or late Hebrew scribe copying one family of manuscripts may have had trouble making sense of Einam, their eye, in the verse, and assumed the scribe before him had confused the Yod and the Vav, and so he made a deliberate alteration that he believed was a correction. He also may have looked at the wider context of the chapter and found an answer to his confusion in verse 8. In this verse, the angel continues to explain the vision and says, Zot harish'ah, this is wickedness. So it would be tempting for him to harmonize something that he found awkward or strange with something that was easier to follow. In that case, it would mean changing Einam, their eye, to Avonam, their iniquity, in order to make it harmonize with Harish'ah, the wickedness. So unfortunately, it didn't give me any of those possible scenarios that would have been very helpful. Now, finally, I asked it, if you had to decide, would you follow the LXX or the MT reading? And its answer is kind of funny. It says, as an AI language model, I am not able to make subjective decisions or take sides in textual debates. Rather, my role is to provide information and present arguments from different perspectives to help users form their own conclusions. In the case of the textual variant in Zechariah 5:6, there are arguments and evidence supporting both the MT readings of their eye and the LXX reading of their iniquity. Scholars have debated this issue for many years, and there is no clear consensus on which reading is correct. And I would say that's correct. That's actually right. It's a really hard variant that could go either way. Then it continues, ultimately the decision of which reading to follow depends on various factors, such as the textual evidence available, the context of the passage, and the theological implications of each reading. It is up to individual scholars and translators to weigh the evidence and make an informed decision based on their own understanding of the text. End quote. So I said, I thought I'd play with it a little bit, you must be glad you don't have to make these kinds of subjective decisions. And it said, as an AI language model, I do not experience emotions, so I cannot say whether I am glad or not. However, I am designed to provide impartial and informative responses to help users make their own informed decisions based on the evidence available. Textual criticism can be a complex and nuanced field, and there are often multiple valid interpretations and perspectives to consider. It is up to scholars and translators to carefully weigh the evidence and make an informed decision based on their own expertise and understanding of the text. End quote. Now, I will add that even though it claims to be impartial in informing people about different things, it is definitely not impartial on all things, especially some of the new kind of controversies that we're facing today. Then just out of curiosity, I asked it, how would you explain Old Testament textual criticism to an audience of non-scholars? And it said, Old Testament textual criticism is the study of the various manuscripts and versions of the Hebrew Bible, or Old Testament, that have been preserved over time with the aim of determining the original text as closely as possible. So parentheses here, this is a big debate as to the aim of textual criticism. Is it really to recover the original text, or is it to recover the finalized, edited, canonical text? Close parentheses. It involves analyzing the differences and variations between different copies of the text and evaluating the evidence to reconstruct what the original text may have been. The process of textual criticism begins with comparing different manuscripts and versions of the text to identify variations, such as differences in spelling, word order, or wording. Scholars then analyze these variations to determine which reading is most likely to be the original, taking into account factors such as the age and reliability of the manuscripts and the context of the passage, and the use of language and literary conventions. The goal of Old Testament textual criticism is to produce a text that is as close as possible to the original autographs, the original manuscripts written by the biblical authors, recognizing that there may be some variations that are irreconcilable or uncertain. By understanding the textual variations and the factors that contribute to them, scholars can gain a deeper understanding of the history and transmission of the biblical text and the context in which it was written. In summary, Old Testament textual criticism is a discipline that seeks to identify and evaluate the variations in the biblical text in order to reconstruct the most likely original reading. It is a complex and nuanced field that requires careful analysis and evaluation of the available evidence, and it can provide valuable insights into the history and context of the biblical text. Not bad at all. I would say that one of the biggest strengths of this machine is the ability to synthesize and summarize things in really well-written language. Now, finally, to finish this whole thing up before it gets too long, I asked it, what's the methodology of Old Testament textual criticism? What are the main considerations or criteria when weighing the evidence? And it said, the methodology of Old Testament textual criticism involves a range of techniques and approaches for evaluating the various manuscripts and versions of the Hebrew Bible or Old Testament to reconstruct the most likely original text. Some of the main considerations and criteria that scholars use when weighing the evidence include, 1, age and provenance of the manuscripts. The age and provenance of a manuscript can provide important clues about its reliability and accuracy. Generally, older manuscripts are considered more reliable than later ones, especially if they were copied from a reliable source. 2, number and consistency of manuscripts. If multiple manuscripts contain the same reading, this can provide evidence for the original text. Consistency between manuscripts can also be an indicator of reliability. 3, textual variance, and it explains that. 4, internal evidence. 5, external evidence. And 6, theological and historical context. All of those are explained, and then it finishes with 7, Occam's razor. Scholars also use the principle of Occam's razor, which suggests that the simplest explanation is usually the best to determine which reading is most likely to be original. By considering these factors and weighing the evidence carefully, scholars can develop a well-supported reconstruction of the original text of the Hebrew Bible. However, it is important to note that textual criticism is an ongoing and evolving field, and new evidence may come to light that can change or refine previous conclusions. Anyway, that's all for this episode. I hope you found that somewhat interesting, and I'll catch you in the next one.